Okay, today is March 27th, 2013. This is Ina Gusenfeld interviewing Jack Kerr, a preservation lawyer, and I think we can get started.
All right.
So in the early 70s, you were a law student at Columbia. And I know that in 1975, you wrote about the Lutheran Church case in the Columbia Journal of Environmental Law. How did this ruling spark your interest in landmarks law?
Actually, it didn't spark my interest in landmarks law. What brought me to landmarks law was my prior life as an archaeologist. Before going to law school, I was a classical archaeologist. And when I went to law school, I was looking for a way that I could continue in some respect my interest in history, historic preservation, and archaeology. And I settled upon writing a student note on the topic. And it's traditional that in your second year of law school, you write a note of some sort, an academic piece. And there's a newly formed environmental law journal at the school. And I became interested in joining the staff of that journal, having discussed with them my idea of writing in the field of historic preservation. And they felt that that was certainly within the area of environmental law that would be of interest to them and their readers. Mm-hmm. So I was fishing around for a topic, and that's when I came across the Lutheran Church case. And it seemed to be, you know, an important and appropriate case to write about, and very timely. So that's really how I came connected to the Lutheran Church case.
And what about the case did you feel was timely or significant?
Well, it was a case where the preservationists lost it in the end. As you know, the court found hardship, and as a result, the designation was removed from the Lutheran Church building, and the Lutheran Church had the right to tear it down. I mean, they had put forward a convincing case of hardship based upon the building not serving the purposes for which they needed it, which was the headquarters of Lutheran Church of America. So it really was one of the first cases that was able to apply and successfully apply the hardship exception to the landmarks law, which was of great interest at the time. The great irony of this, of course, is that the building was never torn down, and it's now part of the Morgan Library.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any interactions with LPC or the Municipal Arts Society and other preservation advocacy groups prior to your work on Penn Central?
I didn't, other than to become aware of the commission and the work of the Municipal Arts Society in the course of my research for the article. But I had no interaction formally with either organization before I began working on the Penn Central case.
And were you, coming from your background, were you interested primarily in preservation law, or did the advocacy side interest you as well?
I was attracted to become a lawyer because of the advocacy. And I had always assumed I would go to law school from the time I started college. Even when I applied to college, I distinctly remember listing pre-law as my area of interest. That didn't change until towards the end of my undergraduate years, when I fell under the sway of a very, very excellent teacher who was a classicist and a historian, probably the best historical classicist of his generation, Sterling Dow. And he really sparked an interest in me in continuing in my study of history. And he was the one who made it possible for me to do graduate work, continue working on a thesis, and eventually work in the field on an archaeological excavation in Greece. I decided to give that up and go to law school because I really did have this powerful desire to be an advocate and have a public life. an engaged public life as opposed to an academic life, which I was, I think, on track for if I stayed in archaeology. I love the field work in archaeology, but I never really saw myself as being an academic full-time.
Right.
So that took me to law school, but what drew me to preservation, really, was more the substantive interest. And as a law student, I was keenly interested in land use and land use planning, in environmental law, and in preservation law. And I thought there was a good chance that my career path would take me in that direction. And when I was interviewing for a job, a summer associate job at the beginning of my second year at Columbia, one of the law firms I interviewed with was Cale Gordon. And by sheer happenstance, the lawyer who I met, who was doing the interviewing that day for Cale Gordon at Columbia, was Ralph Menapace. And when we got talking and he realized my background and realized I was writing an article on the historic preservation topic, he became very engaged. And at the end of the interview, he offered me a position for the summer at Cahill with a chance of working with him and others on the what was then the Penn Central case. So it was the substantive interest that really took me in that direction, though I have to say that in the course of law school, just like studying history and archaeology sort of sidetracked my interest in law for a period, I became very interested in international law. And when I finished at Columbia and took a two-year federal court clerkship in Portland, Oregon, I thought a lot about the two, environmental preservation law versus international law. And I came to the conclusion that I wanted to do both, but the international law would be sort of my day job. It would be what I really did professionally. But I wanted to find a way in my pro bono activity, because after all, much of the historic preservation work was being done pro bono by law firms, that I thought that I could find a way to work in the preservation field as I had at Cahill for nonprofit clients on a pro bono basis.
So when you became involved with Penn Central as an associate at Cahill, I believe it was still in the Court of Appeals.
That's right.
And can you describe the prevailing issues at that juncture when you came in as an associate, and whether you thought at the time the case would actually go to the Supreme Court?
I don't think anyone at that time thought it would go to the Supreme Court. This was the summer of 1975. And, you know, we were still in the state court system, and the issues we were dealing with were first and foremost whether landmarks preservation, and in particular New York City landmark preservation law, was constitutional. I mean, put starkly, it had not been established yet whether landmark preservation was an appropriate extension of the zoning power. That's why in those days land use law was so important in terms of crafting the arguments in the Penn Central case. We and I did a lot of research trying to determine bases upon which to argue that historic preservation was just a legitimate extension of basic zoning principles for which there was a huge body of case law, including numerous Supreme Court cases. But it had never been established that landmarks preservation was a constitutional use of the zoning power. There was a principle in land use that zoning, when applied to a large geographic area, you know, 15 city blocks or a neighborhood, where it touches everybody equally, is a legitimate exercise of what's called the police power, the power of the state.
Right.
On the other hand, something called spot zoning was not. In other words, you can't say, okay, you know, this is an area of 10-story commercial buildings, but this little piece over here is only going to be one story. That would be discriminating. And that's frequently been held unconstitutional when they try to zone a particular parcel. And so by analogy in historic preservation, one could argue that historic districts were more like appropriate zoning, but an individual landmark sounded a lot like spot zoning.
Uh-huh.
The people next door can do whatever they want with their building, but you can't. That was a huge concern, and we spent a lot of time researching that issue. The other area we spent a lot of time thinking and researching was the Fifth Amendment takings. How far could a state go in regulating before it triggered the requirement to compensate? And related to that, I know Ralph Menape spent a lot of time with economists and experts trying to figure a way to argue that having to maintain Grand Central as a railroad station was not a hardship to Penn Central. So he spent probably a lot of time on the economic side of the takings issue, whereas I was focusing a lot more on the theoretical, the legal side of Fifth Amendment takings law. And of course, sharing and working with Paul Byard and Dorothy Minor, all of us, we worked as a team.
So I was going to ask, how did this team come together?
Well, Dorothy, Paul, and Ralph were already working together when I stepped into the picture. The summer associate position usually is about a 10 or 12 week position in the summer. So when I showed up for work in early June, they had already been working on the case, and I came in at a fairly early stage because I was doing some very basic research. So that's, I guess, the simple answer. I joined the team that was already in place.
And you were working to prepare multiple briefs.
Yes.
One for the city and a friend of the court brief for MAS.
We were the principal draftspersons of the MAS brief, which was ours to write. Cahill was representing MAS. And we were sort of a shadow behind the scenes team coordinating with Corporation Counsel and Dorothy Minor doing the city's brief. Paul Byard at the time, I think this was in the transitional period when he was transitioning from law to architecture. I remember that summer he spent a lot of time out in the Hamptons at his summer house, and we would have to send packages back and forth. But he was very much engaged in the very, you know, theoretical side of it, and also working with me drafting.
So how long was your participation in the case? It sounds like you may have worked on it past your time as a summer associate.
I did. I worked throughout the summer, and then I worked as much as I could during the school year on a kind of an as-needed basis.
So from what you recall, what were the immediate effects of the Supreme Court ruling on preservation in New York City?
Well, I think number one, it stated unequivocally that the New York City Landmarks Preservation Law was not unconstitutional, and that it was a legitimate use of the powers of a city. It's interesting, it's referred to as the police power, but includes zoning, which had never, I mean, that was really up for grabs. I mean, it's today, with so many years between that decision and where we sit today, it's hard to really comprehend how on edge the preservation community was over this. An adverse decision from the Supreme Court could have killed the Landmarks Preservation Law and the Landmarks Preservation Commission, and would have, I think, set the country on a very different course in terms of preservation. So it was a moment of jubilation, but it also was an important moment in that the Supreme Court, having thoroughly dissected and analyzed the law, we had a sense of where the potential weak points were going forward. And obviously, the whole takings thing and hardship really was part of it. I mean, the fact that it was a hardship provision, the fact there were ways to ameliorate hardship were critical to the Supreme Court's accepting this as a constitutional use of the zoning power. So I think we felt we dodged the bullet. It's a great landmark case in itself, in the sense that it is established now landmarking as a legitimate use of the zoning power countrywide. But it also meant that we had a lot of work ahead of us in terms of making sure that it was applied in a way that would keep it constitutional, because you always have the question of whether a law is constitutional on its face, whether it's facially defective, or whether it's constitutional as applied. And so we still had to be concerned about the as applied aspect in each case.
Did you feel that it changed the application of the landmarks law or the discretion and power of LPC?
I don't think it changed the law or impacted the discretion of the LPC. I think that it certainly made the LPC aware that it had to take the hardship issue very seriously, and in necessary instances it may have to give up a landmarking if the hardship could not be addressed.
That's interesting. So you were fairly young at the time. You're the last remaining member of that legal team.
I was 25 years old that summer.
What did you gain from your involvement in Penn Central, and how do you feel that it prepared you for your future pro bono work in preservation law and advocacy?
I think, number one, I form lifelong friendships with the people I was working with. And it wasn't just a friendship one cultivates working intensely with somebody over a period of time, but we really shared a common interest, a very deep interest in historic preservation. And so I knew I'd like to find a way to continue working with these people, find other projects. I also felt that, historic preservation, the Landmarks Law, are now here to stay. And it is going to be a legitimate field with opportunities for lawyers like me. So it increased my appetite for doing more work in the field, especially given the fact it was a very young field. And I knew there would be a lot of new and interesting cases as the parameters of the field became more defined. So it really encouraged me to think that that this is something I want to do, and there'll be opportunities in it and great people to work with. Another important event that summer, which is kind of a footnote but it had importance later, is I met Whitney North Seymour, who was working with the Landmarks Conservancy doing an amicus brief in the Penn Central case. And Simpson Thatcher really hadn't been on my radar screen when I was interviewing law firms. And it was probably a huge oversight on my part. But I remember at some point he said to me, you know, when you get back to law school in your third year, why don't you talk to us, consider coming to us? And so that seed was planted in my head. And when I took a closer look at Simpson Thatcher, I realized I knew several people there quite well. And that's where I eventually ended up.
Well, Simon Brines, whom we interviewed a few years back, he talked about you a good deal, and he said that the Landmarks Conservancy would not have survived its early years without the Simpson-Thatcher connection. So what was the extent of your involvement with the Conservancy in the 70s and 80s when you joined STB?
Well, when I joined STB in 1978, in the fall of 78, October 1978, after finishing a two-year clerkship, one of the first people I went to go see was Whitney North Seymour. And he said to me in that very first meeting that he was going to find a way to put me to work on conservancy matters, and he did. So from the very start of my career at Simpson Thatcher, I was working with Whitney Seymour on a range of matters for the Landmarks Conservancy. And as I recall, Laurie Beckelman was executive director at the time, and we became fast friends and collaborators on many things. In my early years, I spent a lot of time, you know, doing basic research and drafting of court documents whenever we were an amicus party or involved in any kind of litigation. That was my principal role because I was a litigator. That's the area of my practice at Simpson Thatcher. But I also became very involved in everything from bylaws to governance and just the practical things that need to be done where a small organization needs an extra pair of hands. So I attended all the board meetings as a sort of junior counsel and assistant to Whitney, who was one of the founding members of the Conservancy. And so Simpson Thatcher was involved with the Conservancy right from the very beginning. I became a member of the board at the Conservancy in 1984, which is right after I became a partner in the firm. And at that point, there had been not only Whitney North Seymour, but Donald Orsman, another Simpson Thatcher partner, had become very involved in the Conservancy, and he was chairman of the Conservancy for a period when Laurie was the executive director. So there's always been senior partner involvement with the Conservancy on the board and recognition by the firm that the Conservancy was a pro bono client of long standing and one of our oldest continuous pro bono clients. So we did a lot for them across the board over the years, and I became sort of the point person at Simpson Thatcher for anyone, any lawyer, any associate, even any paralegal, who had an interest in historic preservation and wanted to do something. And so they would find me, and I would put them to work on conservancy matters. So there were years where we had 10 or 12 people working on the Landmarks Conservancy, ranging from litigation, pro bono litigation, tax advice, bylaws and governance advice, labor advice, and real estate advice. Those are the five areas of the firm that all contributed.
And I've worked at the Conservancy, actually, and I know that their work has always been different from that of other advocacy groups. So can you maybe speak to some of the specific issues or cases you handled for them?
Well, the Conservancy was an outgrowth of the Municipal Art Society. And as I kind of looked into the archives and read a little bit, it seemed to me there were two major motivating objectives in forming a new organization. One was to have an organization that was focused exclusively on historic preservation. The Municipal Art Society has many other interests, including zoning generally and city governance and city art and a lot of other things. So this would be a more focused organization. And number two, the idea was that they wanted an organization that could do projects, that could own real estate, manage real estate, hold easements, but really get in the business of historic preservation, which really means being in some respects in the real estate business. Those are the two aspects. And as a result, you can imagine there's a lot more lawyer involvement when they're doing things like that. A good example is the Federal Archives Building, which the government actually turned over to the Conservancy as an intermediary, as part of deaccessioning it from the federal government and putting it to a nonprofit beneficial use. That was a major real estate transaction, and the fees that were generated to the Conservancy over the years as part of the rental income funded an entire fund at the Conservancy that was used for emergency rescue preservation efforts. It was a very important source of revenue for the Conservancy in achieving its objectives. I think the next project after that was the Francis Tavern block, and then the Customs House and so on. And the Conservancy was able to really get very much involved in the deal of preservation, not just advocacy of it.
So going back to Penn Central, I know you worked on several hardship cases, either directly or indirectly, for LPC. Can you describe your involvement in the Church of St. Paul and St. Andrew case? I know this was a narrow ruling in LPC's favor.
It's been so many years since I worked on that case, and I haven't gone back to look at it recently for the narrow holding, but I can talk generally about the case, certainly. It was a case that was seen to be around for a long time. It was a case where we felt it was going the way of Lutheran Church, in the sense that it was almost hopelessly a hardship. It was a church congregation that had dwindled down to a very small number. They didn't have any resources to maintain the building. They were looking for alternative uses, and there are just only so many churches that you can turn into concert halls. And they were really, we always felt if this thing went to the test in court, we'd probably lose. And so a large part of working with them is trying to help them find some adaptive reuse, share the space with other congregations. Many things were tried over the years. To me, the real work on that case was far broader than the actual final court litigation and the holding. It really showed how much work can be involved in dealing with a landmark property which has serious hardship issues and trying to ameliorate that. That's what I really recall about that case.
As I understood, the ruling hinged on the fact that the church had claimed hardship but had not sought administrative remedies from LPC. So they had not filed the appropriate paperwork.
That rings a bell. I think you're right. This was kind of a Dorothy Minor masterpiece of technical procedure, but you're right. They felt that the hardship was so apparent that they shouldn't have to go to the Landmarks Commission, that going straight to court should be an alternative, that they could prove in a court of law that they had a hardship and therefore they should be exempt from landmark designation. Maybe council on their side felt that the Landmarks Preservation Commission wouldn't give them as a neutral a review as a court would. I don't know what was in their minds, but you're right. It was derailed. The litigation was derailed because they failed to go to the Landmarks Commission to seek hardship and went right to court saying it was unconstitutional as applied to them. That wasn't the end of the story because we always felt, you know, all they had to do was go to the Landmarks Commission and if they were unhappy with the result, they'd be back in court and they'd be through that administrative gate. Which was, I guess, going back to what I said, we spent a lot of time working with them to try to ameliorate the hardship so that they would not end up back in court.
And when you say we...
Well, I was at that time working with the Conservancy. I should say on behalf of the Conservancy, I think probably MAS as well, doing amicus briefs and working hand in glove with Dorothy Miner, who was working with Corporation Counsel to do the city's brief. At least that was in the court part. But it was really more the Conservancy and MAS working with St. Paul and St. Andrews trying to find a way around the hardship for them.
So it's kind of like you were working together, but not necessarily on the same side with Dorothy at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this followed a pattern where the Conservancy could do things the city couldn't. Conservancy had funds it could bring to bear to help a landmark by giving grants and so on to do repairs. It has a technical staff that can then advise a landmark owner. And it has an advocacy position where it could reach out to people to help do something for this church. You know, for example, have you thought there are two other congregations in your neighborhood that are renting space in a gymnasium? Maybe they'd be willing to rent, you know, certain hours a week to have services in your church. That's the kind of thing the city just couldn't and wouldn't get involved in, whereas a Conservancy could.
I know that STB filed there were quite a few amicus briefs in the St. Bart's case. They were presenting, there was a large coalition of advocacy groups. What was your involvement in St. Bart's?
I was one of two lead counsel for the amicus parties involved in this case. I principally, with the Landmarks Conservancy, which was my client, Peter Sloan of Cahill Gordon, who had sort of taken over the historic preservation mantle from Ralph Menapace at Cahill, was representing the Municipal Art Society, and many other organizations signed on as amicus parties with us. But Peter Sloan and I were the lead counsel arguing on behalf of a whole range of pro bono, pro-preservation advocates. City, Dorothy Miner as usual, represented by Corporation Council, and then all aligned with St. Bart's on the other side, though there was a group of dissenters from St. Bart's, led by Sinclair Armstrong, who were close to half of the congregation were against this project, so they too were involved in the litigation. It was unusual in the sense that Judge Sprizzo, who was the federal district court judge who was assigned the case, gave the amicus parties prominence. I mean, frequently as an amicus party, you submit a brief, but you don't have the chance to really stand up and argue in court. Judge Sprizzo loved debate. An argument in his court wasn't, okay, you've got a half hour to make your points, and the judge takes notes and then goes off and decides the case. he had great intellectual curiosity, and it was always a dialogue with him. So he gave us rights of audience to be able to participate in oral arguments and all the various stages of the hearings, and so we were very much involved. There was a committee to save St. Bart's that was formed, I think, principally by the Municipal Art Society, but also by the Conservancy, who was very much involved in this. And it became quite a large, ungainly committee that would meet from time to time, especially when decisions had to be made or when we were getting ready for an important court date to be able to marshal support and have people in the courtroom. But there was a small steering committee that met once a week for breakfast. That really was the guiding force behind this. And that steering committee consisted of Brendan Gill, Philip Johnson, Jackie Onassis, and Whitney North Seymour. And Whitney started taking me to these small breakfast meetings to take notes and do all the follow-up that needed to be done afterwards. And after a couple of months of this, he said to me, you know, I'm too old to be getting up this early in the morning. I'm going to give you my seat on the steering committee. So he dropped off, and I formally became a member of the committee and worked for the rest of the case, meeting for breakfast once a week with this great group. So I was involved not only with the litigation strategy, preparing the briefs and arguing in the court all the way up to the Second Circuit, but also very much involved in the organizational side of it.
How did this suit differ from previous challenges to the Landmarks Law that you had argued or been involved in?
This was very different. I mean, I think to most people in the public, it looked and sounded like a repeat of St. Paul and St. Andrews or even Penn Central. But it was very different in the sense that the principal thrust of the argument here, the constitutional challenge to the law, was based on the First Amendment, the freedom of religion. And there was really a movement that was gaining steam going on of religious institutions concerned about the implications of the Landmarks Law for them. And I think it was becoming accepted wisdom that fighting historic preservation and landmarks laws on the Fifth Amendment takings basis was getting harder and harder because of Penn Central and other cases that began to apply Penn Central, including St. Paul and St. Andrews. So that the new twist on this is that a religious property is different. The church needs the flexibility to make changes to the church and control its property in order to achieve its religious purpose. And to deny that is state interference with religion. And this, there was just no precedent out there for this. This was a really new challenge, and the stakes were high because if this worked, it could mean that religious properties were not covered by the Landmarks Law, that there's a First Amendment exception. And there was an interfaith group, I can't drop the name at the moment, who was really organizing the various religions in New York and nationally to really challenge landmarking for churches and to make an exception, even to the point of getting legislation passed.
Was that RFRA? The Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
That was the act they were eventually working on, but the name of the group escapes me at the moment. It's something like the Interfaith Commission or something mm-hmm. like that. So we had that issue to confront, and I mean, we were, again, this involved going back to the books and doing a lot of research, but it seemed to us that the best way to approach this was from the basis that religious buildings are governed by the same laws for fire regulation, zoning, and all the other things traditionally, and they've never been challenged, they were somehow exempt, and they do impose a financial burden on an institution and so on. The basic dynamic of the argument here was St. Bart's, like many other churches, had a dwindling congregation. The church needed massive amounts of restoration. They didn't have the funds to do it. They had a new rector, and he was looking for a way to deal with this, and they decided that if they sold off the community house and plaza, which are part of the landmark, and knocked it down and let a developer build a high-rise apartment building on that plot. And the developer promised a certain number, I think 6 floors on the ground level for use by the church to replace the lost community house, plus also a percentage of the stream of income from the building to support its religious purposes. So the argument was, we need to do this to maintain our ability to worship here in a church, and the money we'll be getting will be used to achieve our religious mission. And to deny us this on a landmark basis is interfering with religion. It was a very appealing argument on a lot of levels that a lot of religious properties, you know, could accept and adopt. And I distinctly remember Judge Sprizzo at one of our oral arguments putting the question to all counsel, saying, right, let's say that I own St. Bart's Church on Park Avenue, but our religious purpose is going to change. We are now, instead of worshiping, you know, God and the saints inside a domed church and using statues and other, you know, figures to remind you, we are going to worship the sky. And what we need is not a church, but a grass field open to the sky. And so we need to tear down the church in order to achieve our religious purpose. That's a hard question. I mean, if you ever had that really come up. But I think the question we had to do was different, because any source of revenue that goes to a church could be said to be a source of revenue necessary for religious purposes. And if you argued that any government interference in any of those sources of revenue was an unconstitutional interference with religion, you could see where that could go. And I think ultimately that's the way the judge saw the case, that this is not fundamental interference with their mission. It's simply a regulation of their assets and whether or not they would have a flow of income.
I understand that at LPC they had done their research to discover that, in fact, the church had not wrongfully but inaccurately claimed hardship, when in fact they were not suffering economically to the extent that they had represented.
That's where this dissenting group within the church, who had access to the church's books and records and knew the church's finances, were able to show they had substantial assets available to them. Not enough to completely renovate and restore the church, but it became known that part of what was really driving this is Reverend Bowers, who was the new rector, really had in mind a nationwide radio ministry, I guess sort of like Bishop Sheen or whatever. And in order to accomplish this, he needed substantial funding, and that this was part of his grand vision, which the dissenting members of the vestry and congregation, you know, cared little for. They saw that as not their mission. So they were able to, being insiders of the church, really portray a very different economic picture than the church was presenting. It was a great partnership because you had the amicus parties in the city arguing the constitutional issues and constitutional law and the landmarks law, but you had the dissenting congregation members who were very good at providing us with the facts and the facts that were ultimately very critical to the decision.
Were you involved in some of the more recent religious hardship challenges to the landmarks law? There was, I believe it was Park West, the Landmarks Conservancy, I think, filed an amicus brief.
I was involved in every amicus brief the Conservancy filed until 2 years ago when I stepped down from the board after being on the board since 1984. And there were many, many cases that never got to court. We worked on it. It seemed like for a period of more than 15 years, we were working constantly with religious properties in one way or another to prevent them from essentially bringing claims for the Landmarks Commission or the courts challenging those designations. I know the Conservancy worked very closely with the Roman Catholic Diocese as they've been closing schools and churches and making them redundant. There's a similar effort with the Episcopal Church even some years before. And the Conservancy has, the Conservancy has gone through phases. Lori Beckelman, when she was head of the Conservancy, was a tenacious fighter. And she was not afraid of controversy, wasn't afraid of going to court. She had great confidence, still does, in the court system. She had, she thought, good lawyers. And it was at a time when the whole field was in a high state of flux. It was still emerging and developing. And I think the feeling certainly that she had and some other board members, active board members had, was that, the best way to do this is build upon, the Supreme Court victory in Penn Central, continue to develop the law so that we know what we have and that we can put to rest some of these issues that are going to come up over and over again. Peg Breen today is much more of a conciliator, but she's also head of the Conservancy in a very different time when the law has been basically settled and now it's really more of a regulatory issue. It's an application of the law and the regulations. You've gone from having a fairly small number of individual landmarks and historic districts to now quite a large number of buildings covered one way or another by historic preservation in New York, and it's a huge administrative nightmare. So the Conservancy today is far less likely to get involved in litigation, but try to work behind the scenes to head off litigation in the first instance, and to use the resources available to it to try to achieve its objectives through through negotiation. And I think what you find that under the current chair of the Landmarks Commission, that Bob Tierney is of a similar mind. I think he is looking for ways to avoid conflict and to work by consensus. And I guess that really gets into a whole other area of discussion. But getting back to your original question, up until a fairly short time ago, the Conservancy was still very involved in filing amicus briefs in any local or national matter of historic preservation that had constitutional implications.
Do you feel that hardship challenges have strengthened or weakened the landmarks law over time? probably no simple answer to that.
Yeah, I don't think it's weakened or strengthened it. I think it's made it necessary to apply the law more intelligently, because as you have more and more precedents out there for what constitutes a hardship or what an owner might get in return by challenging the basis of hardship, it becomes a fact of life that the Land Rights Commission has to deal with day in and day out. It's not a once in a blue moon sort of instance. And the Conservancy, I think, and other advocate groups, Landmarks West, which has really become much more involved in these issues, have been very good in finding ways to probe on the allegations of hardship, what to be on the lookout for to see if it's a bona fide claim of hardship or whether it's basically a subterfuge to get out from under the landmarks law. So I think it's a necessary part of the law. If you look at the Penn Central case, it's one of the saving aspects of the law that made it constitutional. And I think that there's been a desire to avoid going back to the Supreme Court on a case where the city has arbitrarily decided there is not a hardship, because you just don't want to go back and lose a case before either a major state-level court or the Supreme Court that found that they're contrary to the Land Rights Commission's views, it was a hardship and it's unconstitutional application.
What are your thoughts on St. Vincent's and LPC's actions in that case?
St. Vincent's was a hard case because, again, it was an institution in dire financial straits. It had extremely valuable real estate assets given its location in the West Village. And the need, if it was going to remain a functioning hospital, to have more state-of-the-art operating theaters and everything else that goes with it. And I think it was heading to be, a classic hardship case. Is this a hardship? There are good arguments on both sides because some of their buildings work perfectly well for the purposes they were being used for. The old Siemens Hall that they wanted to tear down, and which really was the focus of a lot of, the landmark debate, had been functioning for years as an outpatient clinic, and it functioned very well for that. And there was no real argument that it was no longer suitable to function as an outpatient clinic. It's just that they wanted to get into a real estate deal that would give them money to build a new building, and that was where the new building would have to go, because the real estate deal and the apartments were going to go on the other side of the avenue, so it's really part of Greenwich Village. It had aspects of St. Bart's all over again. The stream of revenue will save you. But it also was a classic hardship case under the Fifth Amendment takings and so on. What the twist, and I think going into it before the Land Rights Commission, there's a general feeling that it will be decided similar to the way other cases have been decided, that there will be an analysis of the hardship and an application of the hardship principles in the statute. What made this different was the way the commission decided to look at the whole St. Vincent's as one campus. Because it looked to us that St. Vincent's couldn't win the argument that the Siemens Hall no longer functioned as a outpatient clinic or a hospital building. So by bringing in these other, you know, the main hospital buildings, which were not, no one had an interest in preserving them. They're not of any interest. They became part of the hardship equation, which changed the economics completely.
Yeah.
And it was that aspect of it that led the Conservancy and the Historical Society and others to want to challenge it. And in fact did. But that, I mean, I've had numerous conversations with people at the commission about this, and I don't think they ever thought the preservation community would react to this the way they did. I think they thought this was a limited application, but creative use of principles within the Landmarks Law to achieve this result and essentially avoid St. Vincent's going bankrupt and not being able to do this deal. I think there's a lot of, I won't say overt political pressure, but I think everyone felt the seriousness of the situation because St. Vincent's was a very important part of the West Village community, and it really, if it didn't do this deal, it looked like it was going to go bankrupt. So, I think this, you know, it's still present, even though the deal didn't go through, the case became moot, and the decision of the Landmarks Commission is still on the record. And it will be used, I'm sure, as precedent in some of the contexts, and most likely by NYU. That's a concern.
That's interesting. Can you speak a bit more to that, how you see that application of the law affecting a future case like NYU?
Well, in its basic principle, if for example, they have a building they want to demolish, that's either within the historic district or an individual landmark, which still functions perfectly well as a classroom. Under traditional notions of hardship, unless they could show it no longer was suited to the purpose for which it had been used and intended, this is kind of a nonprofit standard, that would be a step towards proving hardship. If they can now argue on a campus-wide basis that this building combined with these other buildings are really a drag on our finances, and you don't just look at this building and whether maintaining this particular building is a hardship, but if you add all these others to it, it becomes significantly easier, I think, to make a case that the whole ensemble has a problem that could lead to a finding of hardship. It is not necessarily successful, but it just changes sort of the whole focus of hardship. You're looking now at other buildings owned by the same owner and whether together there's a hardship.
From your perspective, going back several decades, how has the LPC's interpretation and application of the Landmarks Law evolved over time? As the agency itself has evolved and different administrations have come and gone.
Well, if you'd asked me this question 4 or 5 years ago, I think my answer would have been the commission is shifting its main purpose from an organization that designates landmarks and historic districts to now maintaining and regulating them. The whole permitting process, giving notices of neglect, and, you know, basically administering and preserving the wealth of individual and historic district landmarks that they have. And I think we've all worried about the administrative burden and the cost of doing that. And I thought there were all the signs that that's where it was trending. But there's been a recent and a tremendous boon in new historic districts, especially in outer boroughs. And so it seems to me that maybe it was premature to say that the commission's moving from a designating body to an administering body. And I think this recent spate of new historic districts comes primarily, I think, for two reasons. One is there's always been a sense that the outer boroughs were not getting their fair share of recognition of historic districts and buildings. And I think that there was a period of time there were so many obvious buildings in Manhattan that are of international significance and national significance that were not landmarked yet, that were a higher priority. And so that was the focus in the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s. There are still some, you know, startling buildings that have not been landmarked, and often for very complex reasons. But so that there's always been a recognition at some point, you know, more time should be spent in the outer boroughs. And secondly, I think that especially under this current administration, the Bloomberg administration, neighborhood groups have found landmarking an historic district the most effective way of gaining control over scale, size, and neighborhood, because other aspects of the zoning seem to be closed to them. There's a very pro-development bias in this administration, and it's served New York well in many ways. But I think neighborhoods that feel threatened from losing the scale of their environment turn to creating a historic district as a way to slow down development. So I think the two together have led to really a very active period of creating new historic districts.
How do you feel advocacy groups have evolved in focus, in number, in scale in the last 2-3 decades?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Sure. How do you feel that some of these preservation advocacy groups that you've alluded to have evolved in number, in scale, in scope in the last 2-3 decades?
Well, I think that there are, I think that the main advocacy groups have matured and are no longer resorting regularly to the courts to oppose development and to take on challenges to landmarks law. I think continues to be, as we were talking about earlier, an evolution more towards recognizing that the most effective way to protect landmarks is not constantly being in court, but to educate owners to the benefits of historic districts and landmarking, to providing funds when funds are necessary for rescue or to help individual homeowners and so on, shop owners to restore their buildings in the right way. Maybe it's going to be 20% more expensive to use the right materials, but if you can get a grant of a few thousand dollars from the Conservancy, maybe that'll help. So it's looking at it as a more complicated approach than just advocacy and litigation. So I think certainly for the Conservancy and MAS and some others, there's that maturing process. I also see that, and it's refreshing, that there are constantly new groups being formed, often single issue, single purpose groups, but I think people recognize the power of advocacy groups in historic preservation, and you know that they see historically how other groups have done it and the success they've had. So I think that there's a great awareness today that organization is important and can be successful if sustained. One other aspect of all of this is the last time Dorothy Minor and I saw Ralph Menapace was over dinner downtown after work one night. And the subject we were discussing is building the case for the proposition that historic preservation and landmarks laws add value to communities rather than diminish the value of communities. It seemed to be a knee-jerk reaction all the time that if you create an historic district, you limit development and property values are going to fall. Or if you designate this building, it's going to diminish the building's value because when I sell it, it has all these restrictions and an owner is limited in what it can do or she or he could do. But we felt anecdotally that this is not right, that it may be in some cases. But by and large, especially for historic districts, if you look at Brooklyn Heights, the value that being a historic district has created for those properties, and you could say the same for Georgetown and Washington and the French Quarter in New Orleans, they're prominent examples, but we were looking for someone to do the research and eventually write it up. And we felt rather than fighting this battle over and over again in the courts on hardship issues, wouldn't it be good to have some definitive studies that we could point to? And with Ralph's untimely death, that project got sidetracked for a long time. But I'm thrilled to see that that work has continued in many aspects. There have been articles written and research done. And that's the kind of maturing I think that all of these preservation organizations should be doing. They should be looking at the bigger picture and doing credible studies to persuade the public that this is not a bad thing and that this actually can be great benefit from being part of an historic district.
It seems that with certain cases like Two Columbus Circle, the relationship between advocacy groups and the commission has grown quite contentious. And in fact, there was some discussion of actually suing the Landmarks Preservation Commission for somehow failing to fulfill its administrative duties because the groups felt that it had, under recent administrations, become an open door for developers.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Two Columbus Circle was a very controversial building from the day it was built, and it was controversial as it went into decline and had no use apparently, and then with the proposed renovation, number one, I think the preservation community was split, seriously divided, on whether this building should be a landmark or not. The policy committee of the Landmarks Conservancy looked at this very closely and very carefully, not once but twice, and could not develop a consensus either way. It was the committee split virtually right down the middle. Those who passionately felt it should be preserved and landmarked, the others said, you know, we shouldn't be fighting this battle. This is not that quality of a building. As a result, the Conservancy never took a formal position before the commission or anywhere else on whether it should be a landmark. The Conservancy instead took the position that this building should have its day before the Landmarks Commission. The Landmarks Commission should thoroughly analyze it, have hearings where the public can put input, and make a determination. That was the Conservancy's view, and the Commission was taking the position that they were not going to calendar it. It didn't merit calendaring. And we always felt that as just a disastrous view, because you're not letting the public come forward, and you're not making a decision on the merits. You're just saying, as a perfunctory preliminary matter, you're not going to calendar it. Now, things don't get calendared before the commission for a range of reasons. I've sort of alluded to this earlier, that there are some what would many people think were obvious landmarks in New York that have not been landmarked. And if you look into why, sometimes you'll find out that the owner is dead against it and the commission doesn't want to fight, and that there's no development plan afoot, and so they figure they have time. In other cases, you know, the staff on a very preliminary basis have decided they're not interested in pursuing, which could be devastating to, you know, a small advocacy group who live near the building and feel very strongly about it. So there are various reasons why. And when the commission says, you know, we're not going to calendar it, we're not going to have a hearing on this, there's all the conspiracy theorists come out and say, well, the fix is in, or the mayor has said hands off, or whatever. And it added fuel to the fire. And I think that aspect of it is what really incensed some of the advocacy groups like Landmarks West. And it became ugly. I had the experience of Mike Seymour, Whitney's son, is a retired partner of the firm, and he has an office on the 17th floor, and he was the lead counsel for Landmarks West, challenging the commission, going after Bob Tierney and others. You know, 8 floors above him, I was working on the conservancy side of it. And we never talked to each other about it, but that's how divided this was. And it was a very divisive case. And I think the wounds haven't all healed.
Yeah. Are there any other preservation cases besides the big ones that you've worked on that you'd consider significant?
There have been. Some, you know, I think really in all respects significant, others maybe particularly significant to me. But certainly one that comes to mind is New Jersey against New York, which was the question of who owns Ellis Island. Is it in New Jersey or is it in New York? And that really is a state's right issue. The case was filed as in the U.S. Supreme Court under its original jurisdiction mandate. I think it was original jurisdiction case number 179, maybe off by a few, which means since the time of the formation of the Republic, there only have been 179 cases with original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, and they're usually property disputes between, boundary disputes between states. It was a very complicated case on the law and the history, and it was a fascinating case in that respect because it made you go back and read all the original charters of the creation of the colonies, New Jersey and New York, and how those rights developed over time. But in a nutshell, under the original grants from the King of England, New York included the Hudson River. So New Jersey started at the Jersey shoreline. And in the 1600s and 1700s, that really wasn't much of an issue. But in the 1800s, as commerce picked up, especially along the river, you realize that if you own land in New Jersey and you build a wharf out into the water, your wharf is in New York. And therefore, to the extent New York taxes and regulates commerce, you know, even though you live in New Jersey and your factory is in New Jersey, your wharf is in New York. And for decades, New Jersey tried to negotiate with New York to move the boundary to the middle of the Hudson, which is what you would normally find between other states where the river is the boundary. And New York declined for years and years, and why should it? Eventually, you know, there was litigation, there were requests for intervention by the president. It all got resolved when New York finally agreed to do it, draw the line down the middle of the Hudson River. The question became, what happens when you get to the New York Harbor? And they eventually decided to continue the line right through the harbor and out through the Verrazano Narrows. Not the Verrazano Narrows, because Staten Island's New York, but down through, I guess, the Arthur Kill.
The Kill Van Cull.
Yeah, Kill, right. So it's between Staten Island and Jersey. But when you do that line, a couple of islands, including Ellis Island, fell on the New Jersey side of this line going down the Hudson. And the agreement was that the islands in the harbor remained New York. But New Jersey owned the rights to the seabed. And what was important there were oysters, which is a very important commercial part of New York Harbor. Fast forward to years later, when Ellis Island was expanded, literally, you know, rock and dirt from building the New York City subways was carted out and used as landfill at Ellis Island. And everyone understood and assumed that Ellis Island continued to be New York. Well, the basis for New Jersey's claim was that all that dirt is sitting on their oyster beds. And the original island, they said, no question, it's New York, but it's basically the arrivals hall. But all the rest, especially the hospital aspect, is New Jersey. The interests of the Conservancy and the National Trust had little to do with these ancient treaties and agreements and riparian rights and so on. It had to do with the physical property there. If it's in New York, the New York City Landmarks Preservation Law, you know, governs the buildings, leaving aside, you know, the rights of the federal government here for a moment. If it was in New Jersey, the jurisdiction was Jersey City, which had virtually no landmarks preservation law. It was de minimis. So there was great concern about whether, and there were rumors New Jersey wanted to build a casino there and do other things. There was a concern that if New Jersey owned it, New Jersey had very different ideas on what to do with it. whereas New York seemed to be content to let the buildings lie fallow while they found a grand plan to use them or do something. New York has so many other things going on in the harbor, it wasn't a tourist or an economic imperative to do anything to develop the island. I was engaged by the Conservancy and National Trust to represent the historic preservation interests of the buildings. And we were granted the status of a participant. And this case was actually tried in the Supreme Court building. It was the first case ever tried in the Supreme Court building in Washington. They only hear appeals, arguments on appeals, but this was actually tried there. And ultimately, the court decided that they sided with New Jersey, with the view that the original core is New York, but the landfill part is New Jersey. And this really required the two states to come together and jointly manage the island. And it's been very successful so far. I think we were lucky that the governor of New Jersey at the time, I guess it was Chrissy Whitman, was actually very intelligent in the way she dealt with this. So the worst fears for preservationists were not realized, but I have to say, of all my cases that I've had in historic preservation, it was the most interesting, both in terms of the issues, but also with the novelty of being back in the Supreme Court, and this time trying a case in the Supreme Court, rather than having it there under the traditional argument court, and at a time when I was a very junior lawyer on the team. A couple other cases, I mean, you probably know about some of them, the tobacco warehouse case.
Yes.
Which the Conservancy was very much involved in, which had a very good outcome, both in terms of establishing that the Department of Interior rules about how parks are handled applies to New York City as well as other individuals and organizations. And a little farther afield, I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and I seem to constantly be involved in historic preservation issues there. And it really started some years ago when the Institute for Advanced Study, which owns, in addition to its campus, a magnificent parcel of several hundred acres of ancient forest land, hardwood forests, and farmland. Two farms in particular have been continuously farmed since the 1600s and still look like it could still be in the 1600s. I mean, nothing's changed in that landscape. And it's bordered by the old Quaker Meeting House, which is the oldest building in that area of New Jersey. And it's really the start of the community that became Princeton. And the Institute decided, in order to enhance their foundation, they were drawing down on funds that had been set up for them from day one, and it was not enough to really continue to support them. They needed to take assets and increase their resources, and this was seen to be a fallow asset. So rather than go about a capital campaign, they decided to enter into a deal with a developer to develop the farmland and woods into clustered suburban housing. And a couple of us from Simpson Thatcher, who lived in the Princeton area, organized an advocacy group and began showing up at zoning board meetings and other things, and eventually it led to litigation. But the story turns out very well, because the Institute ultimately agreed that if we could raise a certain amount of money, they'd be willing to sell the development rights. So we raised somewhere around $18 million, a lot of it from the New Jersey State Green Acres Fund, but a lot of individual contributions too, to purchase the development rights from the Institute and put them in permanent trust.
That's great.
So it had a very happy ending, and it's still there today, and it's a tremendous resource to the community.
And are you still, you said that until a couple years ago you were involved in every amicus brief submitted by the Conservancy. Are you still working pro bono in any preservation cases?
I'm not doing anything for the Conservancy. I am... I'm doing a few things. I mean, it seems that there have been numerous instances in my life where my opponent later became a close ally. When the St. Bart's litigation finally ended and the rector left and a new rector was brought in, and the church started going through a healing process of bringing the congregation back together again. They came to the Conservancy and the Municipal Arts Society and said, look, numerous times in the course of the litigation, you said to us, if you would drop this lawsuit, you would work with us to raise money to restore the church. We're now turning to you to do that. And we helped them set up what was called, what's come to be called the St. Bart's Conservancy. And it raises money not from the congregation, but from unaffiliated sources. So, for example, one of the great contributors has been the Waldorf Astoria. Now, they don't want to give money to a church, but they'll give it to a secular foundation in order to commit it to the restoration of the church. And so Kent Barwick and I became the MAS and Conservancy delegates to St. Bart's Conservancy, and we've been working with them now for more than 15 years to organize a capital campaign to approach their neighbors on Park Avenue, corporate neighbors, to help restore the church. And the Conservancy, principally Roger Lang and Alex Herrera, have been very involved in advising the church on what projects to undertake, how to undertake them, starting with the leaders coming down from the roof, which actually go through the walls of the church and were in terrible shape and causing a lot of water damage. So that's one, and I've continued to work. We're not doing litigation for St. Bart's anymore, but it's more restoration fundraising. And a similar thing happened with the Institute for Advanced Study. I eventually went on the board there. I've become very involved at the Institute, and they abut the Princeton Battlefield State Park, which is a Revolutionary War battlefield. And they have a project which to build some additional faculty housing, and a number of groups of reenactors who regularly reenact the Battle of Princeton have taken the view that where the Institute wants to build the faculty housing, even though it's not part of the park, is actually part of the battlefield, an important part of the battlefield. And so there have been threats of litigation, and there have been challenges in the zoning process, and I find myself, again, a kind of a mediator in that. So my role has become sort of a conciliator and mediator these days more than an advocate. So I guess I should also just say that my focus today is more on international historic preservation. I joined the Board of Trustees of the World Monuments Fund 3 years ago. So a lot of my time and effort today is with the World Monuments Fund. And there it is it's a whole range of things, from the legal work one has to do in order to undertake an operation in a foreign country, whether it be an affiliate of the World Monuments Fund, or simply hiring the local team, mm-hmm. and getting all the rights and permits you need in order to restore a project.
So from all your recollections, have you retained any records related to your legal or advocacy work in preservation? Is that all at STB and other law firms you've worked?
The answer is yes. I'm a real pack rat. I keep almost everything, and I do have files for all the cases I worked on. They would tend to be my working file of all the things that I generated and worked on when I worked on a case or matter. I've got extensive Landmarks Conservancy files from board meetings and committee meetings, a lot of them focused on the policy committee, which is the committee that determines the Conservancy's positions on various issues. And that's really where day-to-day the real preservation work of the, at least the advocacy part of the Conservancy functions. The firm also has records, but the firm has a retention policy, whereas I don't. I should, but I don't. So I don't know how much of really old files the firm would still have. I doubt, for example, that Whitney North Seymour's files have survived, though it's possible some have. And that would certainly center on the creation of the Conservancy, his involvement in the Penn Central case, and so on. Though I'm assuming you might be interviewing his son Mike, and Mike may know whether they have any of Whitney's historic preservation files.
And have you considered archiving your papers with any collections as a resource for law students and researchers?
I haven't up until now, and I think it's only because I was probably too busy with my other work to think much about it, and hadn't focused on whether anyone would really want these things. When I retired as a partner at Simpson Thacher 2 years ago, I had to go through the process of moving to a smaller office, and had to confront, you know, my files and actually go through them and organize them. So I know that there's a lot there. I now know where it is. I have an index. So I guess I could think seriously about making these available to a center, and I'd be happy to talk to you or someone else about that.
That would be great. So I think this concludes our interview, or at least part one. So thank you for sharing all of your knowledge as a preservation lawyer in all these cases with us.
Well, I'm very happy to. Thank you very much.
Sure.